Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
There are certain things that we're not going to say either because of mere etiquette or more often because the discussion has gotten past such things. We don't need to have free speech as to whether or not there should be genocide, for example. We don't need to have free speech over whether or not women should be able to vote. You know, we have limited time. But what's going on now is that a certain contingent of people are just making the domain of things that we can't say or that we can only talk about in extremely prescribed ways so large that it's beginning to choke out what most societies would consider any kind of sensible or thriving artistic, moral, or intellectual culture.
Hello, and welcome to Why Is This Happening? With me, your host, Chris Hayes. Well, folks, have you heard that they just passed a law that you can't read Dr. Seuss? Do you know about that? It's true. Biden administration, Democrats, they're going to pass a law that you cannot read Dr. Seuss anymore. The era of tyranny is here. I'm joking and overstating things a little bit because you probably followed the Seuss controversy, maybe tangentially, maybe closely, that basically the Seuss estate decided that several books that Theodore Geisel, Dr. Seuss, had written would be taken out of print because they contained offensive images. And that precipitated a very, very intense week-long news cycle, particularly on Fox News among Republicans, where it was like all they were talking about. It was a little weird because it was while there was a debate about this multi-trillion-dollar COVID relief package, it's while like we're finding our way out of like a once-in-a-hundred-year plague. But it was part of this sort of broader cultural conversation that we've seen happening over the last, I think it's intensified in the last year or two, about what some people call, and I'm going to sort of avoid the term, cancel culture. Because I think that term is like a pair of old sweatpants that has been so stretched out by overuse that it can't hold anything up anymore. But what it is a discussion about, and it's a discussion that's not in some ways that different from debates and discussions we've had at various other points in American history, particularly for me as a child of the 90s, the great PC debate of the 1990s, it is a conversation about speech, taboo, social justice and respect, power and hierarchy, censure and penalty, about what things people can or can't say, should or shouldn't say, in what environments, and what censure should attach to that kind of speech, where we draw lines between speech that is offensive, speech that might even be harmful, and speech that is part of debate, who should draw those lines. All this is really, to me, thorny, interesting, complicated stuff, even though the debate over it I find exhausting, kind of maddening, because it always feels like it's being undertaken in a kind of disingenuous and cudgel-like fashion. And it also seems to me to often go to the abstract over the particular, where the particulars are really the only thing that you can really kind of root yourself in. That said, I'm also, at the same time, I'm kind of like repelled by the debate. I'm drawn to it. Like I'm constantly thinking about it and thinking about what my response would be to this or that. And we don't do it on the show because I'm, you know, again, we're in a plague and like there's a bunch of other stuff. But I also don't think it's nothing. Like I don't think it's unimportant. I don't think it's the stakes are low. I think it's actually an important conversation to have. And it also seems to me like the worst place to do that conversation is Twitter, where, you know, you're bound by 240 characters. There's a lot of dunking. There's a lot of like sort of intentional misreading. And so I've been wanting to kind of talk through this in a way with someone who, particularly someone who's coming at it, I think, from a somewhat different perspective than I am, or at least who's kind of first principle commitments and experience with this is a bit different than mine. And I've been reading and listening to John McWhorter for many years. He's a really fascinating thinker, intellectual writer, and scholar. His sort of academic work is often focused on linguistics, on natural use of language, how language changes over time, the incredible multiplicity of purposes language can be put to, how the questions of what is and isn't acceptable change over time, the boundaries of language. In fact, his latest book is called 9 Nasty Words, English in the Gutter, Then, Now, and Forever. But he's also someone who I think has a very has through the years in his writing and thinking had a heterodox view of some of these questions. He's been very difficult to sort of categorize or pigeonhole or pin down in terms of what the particularities of his politics are. He often will engage in interesting conversations with a professor Brown by the name of Glenn Lowry, which you can catch online. And I know that John is someone who's coming at this with a, you know, who is in a sort of school of thought along with a lot of other thinkers that there is a real threat here. There's a real problem in the level of censoriousness and the censure that is attached to what we consider harmful, offensive, or wayward speech, and that there's a battle, actually, a very important philosophical and sort of first principles, political and moral battle about, you know, speech. And so I thought, well, John's someone I really like talking to, even arguing with, and so I thought it would be a good opportunity for us to talk through this. So John McWhorter, great to have you on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
How does that work as an introduction to what to the topic?
That was absolutely perfect. I was just sitting here thinking, boy, this sums it up better than anybody I have heard do it.
And, oh, well, yeah. We didn't script that, just to be honest. But so I'm not quite sure where to start it. Here's one thing that I thought would be a useful thing that I feel like is often not present in these discussions, right? In almost any situation, whether it's let's take the law out of it for a second, right? Let's just talk about, you know, whether it's a dinner party or it's you're up in front of a classroom or it's a meeting at work, right? In any situation, there's going to be boundaries to what kind of speech is or is not appropriate.
Always.
Yeah. Always.
Yeah.
And the question, a lot of the debates we're having right now isn't about should such boundaries exist, because they just always do, whether that's a matter of a social fact or that's a matter of, you know, a sort of social justice imperative or a, you know, legal question of, you know, discrimination, hostile workplace, right?
Right.
That those boundaries are going to exist. We're just having a very intense meta debate about where they should be and who should define where they are. Is that, how do you see that?
That is exactly it. The issue is not free speech, because no society of human beings could ever have perfectly free speech. There are certain things that we're not going to say either because of mere etiquette or more often because the discussion has gotten past such things. We don't need to have free speech as to whether or not there should be genocide, for example. We don't need to have free speech over whether or not women should be able to vote. You know, we have limited time. But what's going on now is that a certain contingent of people are just making the domain of things that we can't say or that we can only talk about in extremely prescribed ways so large that it's beginning to choke out what most societies would consider any kind of sensible or thriving artistic, moral, or intellectual culture. That's the problem. And of course, you know, Dr. Seuss, there are, you know, limits to how much we probably want to talk about that, especially given that it was only some of the books. And, you know, Dr. Seuss was great, but, yeah, Dr. Seuss. But the thing is, 5 years ago, we were having that conversation about what could be said on a college campus, which speakers could be brought. The problem today is that that whole thing turns out to have been a prelude to this thing that we're now calling a racial reckoning, where that kind of prescription of not just free speech, but what many people would regard as just basic human social and verbal intercourse is being extended to the warp and woof of our whole nation. That is a problem.
Okay, so I think there's a few different things happening that I want to try to be as specific as possible here, because I have different views on different things. So one example you gave is like people being invited to campus. And, you know, this is a story old as time, right? I mean, I remember we had a huge battle over Dinesh D'Souza coming to Brown when I was an undergraduate there. And like, you know, I think, again, that's a different thing to me about the sort of, like, who can write for your paper, who can come to campus is a slightly different category than, like, should someone face employment sanction for a Facebook post?
Exactly.
Right? Like there's these sort of, so I always want to be sort of specific about what is the speech, what's the pattern and context, and then what's the censure? Because when people say, well, you can't say anything, it's like, well, you can, right? I mean, when you say that, and I get the sort of idea that basically your contention and the contention of, I think, a fair number of people, and some people who I really respect, some people who I don't, to be clear, is that sort of those boundaries are being sort of marched inwards in which they are proscribing increasingly large amounts of exchange and debate and conversation and speech that should be within the defensible bounds of open exchange, but are now being cordoned off in a kind of place that we put real kind of moral transgression.
Yeah, and more to the point, one can say should, but the crucial issue here is that I think a critical mass of people would say should not, but we're being told by a certain cadre of people that these prescriptions should be in place, and the way they exert their power is through fear. We're having this truly frightening kind of cultural development where a large number of people do as they're told because they're afraid of being called, for example, racists on Twitter in particular. And that's not the way change is supposed to happen. Change is supposed to happen because of a gradually emerging consensus. And of course, that can be contentious. Of course, that can be messy. But it's not supposed to be ordinary people who aren't up for a fight cowering in fear because something recently invented called social media can make it so that they can be called a really dirty name in public. And increasingly, so many of our institutions, and not just universities, are operating according to that craven principle.
Right. So there's a sort of normative question here and then a descriptive one about the ways in which these things change, right? So in terms of what the evolution of what taboo is, where the line is, okay? Mm-hmm. So what you're saying, what I'm hearing from you is that, like, look, you would concede that what can be said in what context and what stands on one side of the line of, like, to be excluded and shamed, it changes over time. And your point is that it should change over time through the sort of process of debate and consensus and not through the kind of like bludgeoning of of shame. But I'm also not sure that's true. Like, just again, as a descriptive matter rather than a normative one, you can say, well, that's the ideal speech conditions to move things in that direction. But it does strike me that like shame as a means of of exiling certain words. I mean, here's the example. This is the one I keep coming back to, okay? And I think this might be a good way to concretize this. I experience all this. The thing I keep thinking about is an anti-gay slur that begins with the letter F. This was a very commonly deployed word in my teenage years. It brings me great shame that that's the case. I mean, horrible shame that that's the case. It was a fairly liberal milieu in New York City public schools, but people used it. I'm sure I used the word. And it was used in a pretty awful way, in a way that blows my mind now, like that it was. I mean, blows my mind when I think about it. And I sort of – I guess what I have to do is I have to figure out whatever theory you're espousing, okay, how it integrates to me the clear and obvious moral progress of the fact that that word – was exiled, and that I think my understanding is that, like, I think 15-year-olds don't really deploy it.
Not as much.
Not as much.
Right.
And so the question is, well, what's the theory for how that good stuff happens, and how do we distinguish that from the stuff that you think is sort of scary and totalitarian?
Right. So, yes, shame is something that will always have a place in society, and it gets great things done, such as getting rid of the common use of slurs like that, such as, you know, holding adultery down to a certain level, such as keeping
it's an amazing second example.
Frankly, it's one I would
working
think
well enough to hold it down a bit.
Down a bit. You know, keeping people from smoking as much as they used to. Yes, shame is something that can be useful. But the issue here is what we decide we want to happen. I think there is a critical mass of people who say that it is a good thing that those sorts of slurs aren't used as freely as they were about 10 minutes ago. But the problem is that we're using that same kind of shame to do things where I don't think we have that kind of consensus. And so, quick example, Museum of Modern Art in San Francisco, the head of it says that he's not going to stop taking white artists into consideration for being part of the museum's collection completely. He wants to look at a more diverse range of artists, certainly, but he's not going to look away from white artists completely because that would constitute reverse racism. Because he used the term reverse racism, that man was fired. Now, the question is, to what end? And so you may say, we're going to use shame to keep people from ever saying reverse racism because a certain cadre of people believe that there's no such thing as a black person being racist. And of course, there's a whole lot of controversy over that, but never mind, those people say it loud enough. And next thing you know, that man is fired so that what? Now, of course, this is being done in the context of this racial reckoning, the idea being that his being fired for saying that makes this a better world because it helps to dismantle structures of entrenched racism. But really, does it? When about a half mile across town, there are plenty of black people who are starving out on the streets, and the effort that went into getting Gary Garrels fired could have gone into efforts to address the homelessness problem in San Francisco. I find that that is where the shame is being used by a small number of scary people to do something most people would consider unnecessary.
Right. So, okay. So there's some common ground here, I think, which I want to mine. So one of the critiques is a kind of vanguardism, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a critique that says some vanguard of people who have come up with some set of prohibitions
mm-hmm.
and their representativeness and their power is a little unclear, like where's it come from, mm-hmm. are now prescribing things, and that that's mm-hmm. not reflective, that they don't represent anyone, right? So that's like one of the arguments, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, to go back to the Seuss, the Seuss example, what was interesting about the Seuss example is that I watched it ping back and forth, and I sort of, again, in this kind of very polarized way. And I thought it was a little silly that they were reading Seuss on the floor of the House of Representatives. And then, someone on our staff, I said, did anyone upload all these books? I would like to look at all of them, right? So so they uploaded them, and I looked at them, and it was sort of fascinating because, you know, there's one image that's just like shockingly off.
Transparently
that, racist.
The African natives, right?
Exactly, yes. Yeah. The African natives in a way that, like, yes, that's – yeah.
That would shock anybody seeing it today.
There's a picture of a man in Mulberry Street who's called a Chinaman.
And I have that here in my house and have showed it to my girls. And I've said, this is an old book. This is something they used to pull then. That's not what Chinese people are like.
Right. And that's, I think also racist and also, I think, defensible to get rid of it, but a little more borderline than the Africans. Again, I'm a white man who's making these judgments. So I feel
the same way. Yeah,
I'm just talking about myself, right? Then there's Miguel Agat's Pool, and you get to what I think was, there's an Eskimo at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very, like, you know, it's a cartoonish Eskimo,
right?
In sort of heavy fur kind
with
of
the parka, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
And I think that was the offending image in that book.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the points that, you know, David Wallace Wells pointed out in a pretty good piece in the New Yorker that cased this controversy was, like, it's not clear that there were complaints from indigenous people of, mm-hmm. say, Alaska about this book and image. Someone mm-hmm. somewhere decided that this was offensive to, you know, they had this panel of, I think, scholars, I think they put mm-hmm. together. But that to me does, like, this question of sort of representation and who's doing the deciding does seem to matter to me, right? So mm-hmm. there's a place where, like, I don't know the history and the harm of the images of indigenous folks, particularly indigenous folks of Alaska, has been. Mm-hmm. If those people said, this is a very harmful image, we mm-hmm. should find, then I would be like, yeah, that seems like that makes sense. But in this case, it did feel like it wasn't, it was just unclear where it came from.
Yeah, and this is why another thing that's worrisome about all of this, there's the issue of representativeness, and there's the issue of what the real purpose often seems to be. And we use the term virtue signaling, and it's getting so loaded that it's become almost a slur in itself. But what I'm seeing is a certain kind of person, usually white, who is trying to show that they understand right. oppression. And it's important that people show that they understand oppression. 50 years ago, nobody would have ever heard of such a thing. But if what you're doing is showing that you understand oppression by doing things that even the people of color don't really care about, then something is wrong. With Dr. Seuss, the world's going to keep spinning. But this sort of thing is also, as we both know, losing people jobs.
Okay, so then that gets to the second point, I think, of some common ground, which I actually think is sort of an interesting left-right synthesis here, which is this. To me, some of the most questionable examples of this are happening in institutions that are themselves fiercely inegalitarian.
Mm-hmm.
Hierarchical, mm-hmm. often white dominated,
mm-hmm.
both presently and historically, that are rather than, like, it's like, you know, there's the stories about private schools, right? So, you know, Dalton or something. It's like, well, how do you make an egalitarian and woke Dalton? And it's like, you can't. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. the whole, like, and that might, maybe that's true of the San Francisco Museum. Like, to me, a lot of the excesses here actually seem to not be about genuine investment in social justice so much as they seem to be often white-dominated institutions doing some weird performance of,
yes,
of equality so as to preserve the institution, which is itself in its absolute DNA and fundaments, mm-hmm. inegalitarian.
And of course, the thing is that I think a lot of these people will see that no matter what happens, and this is where it gets into a side of this that I hate to talk about. Now, I'm a black person, and I don't like saying this about the black side of this, but in many cases, the people in question will never be satisfied. And so, for example, I doubt from what I've seen of the whole Dalton scenario that anything that was done would keep a certain contingent from not continuing to say that we need to address the past and that we need to make this a completely non-racist institution. And the problem with it is that what you see in many of, for example, these institutions or these artistic endeavors is a very artificial notion that the issue of oppression and the issue of systemic racism is somehow the main thing that we must be thinking about that dominates in importance anything else for the foreseeable future. That is a point one might make carefully, and you would convince some people, but it's hardly truth. And we're being taught to pretend that, for example, a Dalton where learning about oppression ends up dominating every single subject, we're supposed to pretend that that is ineluctable, unassailable truth incarnate. And it simply isn't. We're pretending. And that's the problem. All of this involves so much mendacity and, as you say, performance. And it means that it's an unhealthy society we're creating.
Right. But there, but okay. But on the other side of it, it's like the education people get about racial equality in this country sucks. Like, people don't know who Nathan Bedford Forrest is. We did a whole thing on the other day. They don't have no idea what Nathan Bedford Forrest is. They don't know what happened at Fort Pillow. They don't know about, like, what happened in Reconstruction. Like, the history that's been taught in this country about particularly Reconstruction, a period I'm incredibly obsessed with, and Redemption, the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. I remember myself, in my liberal, extremely, extremely high-performance magnet high school in New York City, and my teacher actually pushed against this, to his great credit, because he's a great hero of mine, actually. Mm-hmm. But the textbook Andrew Johnson impeachment was like, oh, these crazy radical Republicans, like, really screwed this Andrew Johnson. They really made mountains out of molehills. Like,
what book was this?
It was just like our standard, and that was the standard way Johnson's impeachment was taught. Like,
oh, wow.
One of the worst villains and rascals in American history. My point being that, like, it's okay, fine. Like, yes, are there excesses in whatever, you know, anti-racist training are happening in certain corporate environments or in Dalton's curriculum? You know, again, case by case. I can't say, like, I want to be very specific about what is this curriculum, what use is it being put to. But it's also the case that, like, it's not like this is a reaction against nothing, right? I mean, to me, a huge part of what we've seen, and particularly what I think has precipitated this, is like a real frustration that a certain level of genuine racial equality has been dangled like a carrot in front of the donkey for years, and that it never seems to come about. And that's borne out in a lot of statistical fashions, whether it's wealth or housing or school integration, all these things. And that the theory of the case, I think, is that that's partly because it's never centered, that it's sort of invisible, and that to center it and make it visible is the necessary intellectual and pedagogical precondition for doing anything about it.
Yeah, definitely. But Chris, I want to try something here. On the one hand, we almost chuckle warmly at how historically ignorant Americans of all walks are about everything in our history. And of course, something needs to be done about it. But history has never been the soul of what an American person was. Reams have been written about that.
Right.
And yet the idea now is that there's supposed to be an exception. I'm not sure to what extent Americans are supposed to be informed about our racial history. But I get the feeling, and I've been reading this, especially since about 2013 or 14, there's this dream that all Americans who've been anywhere near a school are going to be able to do a kind of a mini recitation about the history of black people in this country. And this is the thing. One, I find that unrealistic because most human beings on earth are not historians. Most people live in the present. And two, I'm genuinely not sure why this degree of historical knowledge is necessary. And I'm not saying that anybody is expecting every white person, not to mention Indian person, Korean immigrant, et cetera, to be able to explain, you know, when Harriet Tubman was born or something like that. I mean, even the broad outlines, I'm not sure that we need that. And when I say we, I mean both America and myself. It seems to me that we could do an awful lot of great things for black people who need help on the ground without the idea that there needs to be this re-education program. I genuinely don't understand why that needs to be the case. Nobody asked for that in 1964. What's different now?
Is that true? Well, that's not true that nobody asked for that.
But it wasn't a resonant, it wasn't a resonant ask. Martin Luther King wasn't saying everybody in the nation should be able to recite right. the history. He didn't care. He was working for actual conditions for Black people here on the ground. That I'm still thinking about those conditions and the work that remains to be done.
No, but I actually think the better, to me, the more, again, you know, again, we're talking historical analogs here, so I'm not making a moral analog at all, just to be clear. Mm-hmm. But like, in some ways, like when you look at the sort of moral fervor of the abolitionist movement, mm-hmm. and it's frankly incredibly vanguardist methods, right? I mean, mm-hmm. this was a tiny, tiny – Eric Foner always talks about this, right? A tiny, 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 tiny movement in numerical mm-hmm. terms.
You know, that worked, right.
That worked, right? And it was about creating a kind of Copernican revolution in the moral universe of white people,
yep.
right?
Yep.
And – I think there's something that's happening now. Like, it seems crazy to me to not credit that there's something happening now mm-hmm. in a positive way in that. Now, the question is how that cashes out in politics and how that cashes out in material conditions. And I think the critique that I find that I'm sympathetic to is if you're paying off your white guilt with, you know, being very angry at the head of the museum in San Francisco and or mm-hmm. doing this training, but like you definitely don't want to make sure that your kid's school is integrated, well, then it's mm-hmm. it's not. But mm-hmm. I also think that it's the case that like there are ways in which the political public opinion, particularly of a certain cohort of white people, is moving in the right direction and tangibly cashing out in politics in egalitarian ways.
Yeah. However, I would also
You would not concede that?
I mean,
I guess my point is that like whatever the excesses are, it's like it seems to me that like you just find the whole project suspect, and I'm not sure I do. I feel like there's something to it.
No. I know what you mean about some of the political gains. I understand that completely, especially given, for example, what's just happened in Washington. But on the other hand, I don't think that it's trivial that so much damage, so much unnecessary despair, so much unnecessary both verbal and professional abuse is going on in other places in the name of what's supposed to be the same movement. And so, for example, you know, I now have I was saying 110 last June. Now I'm sure it's 1,000 at this point. Missives that I've gotten from academics and high school and middle school teachers, not to mention students all over the country, who are utterly chilled at, frankly, the chilling of possible dialogue of what one is allowed to say, what one is allowed to study, what one is allowed to make a course about, faculty being dismissed and fired, deans being dismissed and fired for saying the wrong thing. There is a real crisis going on. Like, Chris, for example, you know that if there is something like Black law students at the University of Illinois in Chicago claiming that they had heart palpitations because on a law school exam that was about employment discrimination, the professor included N and then 5 asterisks, and that's how he depicted the N-word. Didn't spell it out. And for years before, no one had said anything about that exam. But this year, a group of students are still in the process of trying to have this poor man fired for including that on the exam. And more to the point, that's not an isolated story. There are now hundreds of these stories, literally hundreds. Don't you think that it matters? I think it matters.
Well, so here's where I think this gets very thorny. And again, this is my own sort of subjective rootedness here, I think, is I have to acknowledge, right? Which is that I'm an extremely privileged white straight cis man, and I just don't have the ability to internally subjectively experience life as, say, a Black law student at University of Chicago. I can try to sort of expand out my
But what would the difference have been between this year and the years before?
Well, but here's the question, right? Like, so there's a few things about that. Okay, so one of them is people accommodate to really fucked up situations, and then a certain thing happens and they stop accommodating. So like we've seen that with Me Too, where there were workplace dynamics that went on for years.
Sure.
That were fine. And then one day it was like, wait a second. When my boss kept talking about my outfits every day,
sure.
like actually that was messed up and actually that was doing something messed up to me. And the expectation was that that was fine and normal, but it's not anymore. And I think actually, because I think there's a connection, right, between Me Too and some of this conversation, mm-hmm. I do think there's some people who have had that same reaction of like, wait, we woke up one day and it's not okay to do this thing we did for 25 years. But and like maybe a thing that was happening for 25 years wasn't good, right?
That's part of how social revolutions happen. And it's important, but as always, you end up getting stuck on the issue of degree. And five asterisks, come on. I think that if we allow that that is the sort of thing that people are just not going to put up with anymore when we're talking about a law school exam about employment discrimination where the people going out into the world are going to see the actual word. I think there, I get what you mean about you're the straight, cis, white man, and who are you to judge?
I think if
we allow cases like that to be taken as revolution and as progress rather than, as I hate to say this, a kind of performance art, then we end up condescending to black people rather than elevating them.
So I don't think that's a crazy argument you're making at all, right? So I'm not even arguing mm-hmm. against it in this case because, to be honest, I haven't actually followed the particulars of this example. Mm-hmm. The facts as you present them seem to me like that person shouldn't be fired, but I have not dug into it. That mm-hmm. said, I'm just trying to make a sort of broader theoretical point here, right? Which is one that part of what's happening and part of what's so messy about what's happening is that like there can be things that people have acculturated to as normal that shouldn't be normal and a consciousness changes that sort of snaps something, right? A.
Sure.
And B, the harder thing to me, and this to me gets to the nub of it, and there's someone who wrote about this years ago who I'm sure you've read and admired, Stanley Crouch, who I used to read and love.
Lionized him, yes.
Yes, I know. He's an intellectual hero, I think, of a lot of people in yours. And I often disagree with Stanley Crouch, but I found him fascinating. Mm-hmm. And back during the last iteration of these kinds of debates, right? You know, he would talk a bit about the sort of interiority or psychologicalization of these of political debates. Mm-hmm. About the sort of way one feels about the world. Mm-hmm. And I think this is where this territory gets very, very difficult and messy, right? Because you can say at one level, it's like, I want to say, well, we should be able to debate this topic, or we should be able to have a conversation or back and forth about what words are not out of bounds. Mm-hmm. And then another person can say that debate itself or the experience of it is doing something to me subjectively. That's actually like genuinely sucks, you know, whether you use the word of harmful or traumatic mm-hmm. or there's all the or sort of psychological language, but like genuinely I really it's not doing a good thing to me, and the not good thing it's doing to me is sort of bound up in a power relationship, and there's a kind of unbridgeable gap in that exchange, because at one level it's like I have to take your word for it, at another mm-hmm. level if someone says that to me about a topic like when you talk to me about tax rates that does a harm to me, I want to be like, yo, we can't make it the case that we can't argue about tax rates, right? Mm-hmm. So it's mm-hmm. like, I get the impulse to be like, it cannot be the case that you use your subjective experience of a thing to unilaterally draw a line about what it isn't debatable. At the same time, there are plenty of examples where if a coworker was running around wanting to debate about like what actually constitutes sexual assault with a female coworker all the time, you'd be like, buddy, back the fuck up. Like, you're harassing me.
Sure. Yeah. There is always this, where do you draw the line? And the reason that I have come out and started crusading so hard against this sort of thing just since last summer is that I think we are so far from the line in many of these cases. And so, right. yes, to an extent, the idea that we're going to have a conversation about whether or not this is harmful, that can be overdone completely, of course. But when you have a situation such as a white communications professor says that when you want to hedge and you want to say like in Mandarin, one way they say that is naga, naga, naga. And a group of black students say that that hurt them for the reason that you might be able to imagine, and he gets suspended from the course. I'm sorry, that's not up near the line. That is something that I think as a society we lack the maturity to be able to discuss because we're afraid to discuss it when it comes to black people, which I completely understand. But you're dealing with people who are building an identity around being a victim. This is something human beings do. It's not a black thing. But when black people happen to exhibit that particular trait, I think we're at a point in our society, especially since last June, where people are inclined to just say, well, okay. And unfortunately, it's dangerous because it's not treating black people as equals, not to mention creating an awful lot of smoke and destruction.
So let's talk about the sort of this notion of victims and sort of the bedfellows of the political coalition on this debate, which I think is also part of it, right after we take this quick break.
Hey, this is Jeff Lewis from Radio Andy. Live and uncensored, catch me talking with my friends about my latest obsessions, relationship issues, and bodily ailments. With that kind of drama that seems to follow me, you never know what's going to happen.
You can listen to Jeff Lewis Live at home or anywhere you are. Download the SiriusXM app for over 425 channels of ad-free music, sports, entertainment, and more. Subscribe now and get 3 months free. Offer details apply.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
The other inescapable part of this, you mentioned this sort of victim mentality, and I think that like that connects to this sort of elephant in the room of this whole conversation as well, which is the political valences of it, right? Like, it's a little hard because a lot of the people who are taking up this cudgel or taking up this crusade, and part of the reason I want to talk to you is because I really like and respect you and think you are not in this category.
Thank you.
Well, no, you're not a reactionary bigot, right? And some of them are.
I try not to be, yes.
Well,
exactly.
But some of them are. I mean, a lot of them are. And this, you know, look, when I was a kid and it was like, you know, in the 90s, like, don't say the F word, you know, to refer to gay people. It's like, oh, you can't say anything anymore. All this political correctness. Like, and the Z Morning, you know, the zoo shows would like, that would play on the air with like these, like, you know, essentially verbal blackface, like making fun of black people. Like, that was just everywhere. And when people would call it out, it would be like, it's the same refrain, right? So it's like, it does seem to me like there are a lot of people who are crusading on this, who are actually reactionary bigots, or essentially empowering them.
And here's the thing. It's all about perspective. And so I think a lot of people would say that, okay, yes, there are some excesses with this racial reckoning in the new crusade, but, you know, if you want to make an omelet, you have to break some eggs. Life is never perfect. And really, in the grand scheme of things, something great is happening. And I would say that if one is going to push back against the excesses, and a lot of the reason I'm doing it is because, in a way, all of this is being done in my name as a black person, not individually, and I feel condescended to and diminished by it in the name of my people. If I'm going to be somebody who pushes back, quite aware that my being black means that it's harder to say that I'm a white supremacist, even though some people are going to say it anyway. I know that, yeah, there are going to be some of these yee-haw, ignorant, racist people who come along with it. I'm not sure I see the evidence that they are the dominant strain of it. I'm not sure that I see the evidence that they drive it, but they are there. Their very presence, as long as I'm not working with them or, you know, egging them on directly or telling them that I'm in their corner, their very presence to me is not something that I can spray for as if it was some sort of fungus. I can't make that go away. But those people can't make someone like me not speak up and very directly and over a long period of time. They'll always be there. And Chris, you and I may differ on this or we may not. There will always be some such people. The idea is to make them as few as possible. I always say Emmett Till wasn't killed by a hate group. He was just killed by some people, and, you know, everybody who those people knew basically agreed or would wink and let it pass. Today, he would be killed by uniquely hateful people who would be despised by even most of their community. That's the difference. The idea that there would never be that kind of person, I'm not sure I would know how to push for that because people are imperfect.
All right, but let me, I mean, just to push back gently on that. I mean, you know, the most watched network in America, which had a direct line to the most powerful person on the planet for a long time, is just like immersed in this stuff all the time. And it's inherently connected and inseparable from a project about American hierarchy and who's a real American and you know, the rhetoric they have about immigrants and the rhetoric about black people on that network particularly, which is disgusting, which often features like random videos of black people committing violence against white people like for no reason. Like, you know, that's a big project. And I think to the extent there's a reckoning that's happened that's produced things that you view as excessive and I think individual instances, which I probably view as excessive. Mm-hmm. I think you can't separate the fact that, like, the experience of the country in many ways over the last few years was the profound power of a certain conception of who gets to be an American.
I don't know, Chris. I'm not sure.
You don't think that that doesn't play a role in it?
Oh, no, I'm not denying what you're saying. I'm just saying that I'm not sure where you get the idea that that group is winning. I mean, it's horrible to watch.
Oh, they're losing.
People.
They're losing. I actually don't think they're winning. But in some ways, that's kind of my point, right? Like, I think they're losing because I think the country is actually moving in a better direction. But I guess that the friction of that conflict that we're sort of discussing right now and kind of sitting on the fault lines of is essentially the engine of that progress, right?
This is the thing, Chris. Okay, let's say that we say that, yeah, those people are losing, but there certainly are a lot of them, and you never know whether the tide may shift, and look who was president for 4 years, et cetera. But from my perspective, and now I'm sitting here arguing, you have to see it from my eyes, and I don't mean that at all, but I see another side where people are reading Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility, which I sincerely believe to be one of the worst books ever written, and I'm not being rhetorical. It makes no sense, and more to the point, it depicts me as a crying, diapered baby. To see people on social media holding that book up and saying, I'm doing the work, and then to also, and I have to be very careful, and I don't want to go off on one of these rants that right. Glenn Lowry and I go off on, but for people to be taking the Manichaean dichotomous ideas of a certain Ibram X. Kendi mm-hmm. as some kind of gospel and treating him as if he were Harold Bloom or James Baldwin, that is the most condescending thing I have ever seen expressed about Black people in my particular life, including the sorts of things that you see on Fox News. Somebody needs to push things back into the middle. And so I understand who the bedfellows may seem to be, and I try very hard to avoid any direct connection with such bedfellows. I've done that in many ways. But I can't say that I won't do what I'm doing because I see so much of this as a profound insult to Black intelligence, morality, and legitimacy.
Well, let me ask you a descriptive question here.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is going on? So what's your theory of what? So if my theory of this is, my theory of what we're seeing is social change, an attempt to actually stitch together genuine multiracial democracy in America for essentially the first time since Reconstruction, which was killed by white supremacy. I mean, in a very, very literal sense, right?
Yeah.
And that it's very difficult to do that, that multiracial democracies of our size and scope, there's no real good, great record for, that same fissure is tearing apart huge parts of the democratic world, and that bringing together pluralistic majorities in the project of self-rule in an equitable fashion is essentially like, it's like magic. Like, mm-hmm. It's like a very hard thing to do. Mm-hmm. And in that project, there are very difficult sources of conflict that are being sort of hashed out mm-hmm. in a effort to produce that, right? And that part of that, I think, has white people, particularly white people of a certain class cohort, though not exclusively, attempting to broaden their minds and become more serious about how they understand other people's positionality and the role mm-hmm. they played in U.S. history. And that has led to lots of excesses. And again, my aesthetic feeling about what you're saying about, like, I'm doing the work is exactly the same. Like, I find it incredibly cringy. I wrote a book about criminal justice in America in which I would go speak to crowds that were often, they were often quite integrated crowds because of the subject of the book and because of the audience for our show. But there was a lot of white folks. And I would say things like, what you should do is you should go and, like, work in your local ward to, like,
exactly.
make sure that housing is integrated,
that's,
right?
That's
like
the work.
Like,
exactly.
yeah, right. Yeah. And I would always say that. Like, I don't want to, you know, whatever signs you want to put up, like, that's the thing to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
When they start passing around the petition to stop the women's shelter from coming to your neighborhood, like, you tell them to go shove it up where the right. sun don't shine, and you go and talk to your alderman and say, I want that women's shelter in my neighborhood. Because – so that to me, I sort of agree with. But this is a long way of saying my theory for whatever excesses there are here –
mm-hmm.
Are as part of this broader movement, and that movements like that tend to have excesses and tend to have people that get pulled in by the aesthetics of it, people that get pulled in mm-hmm. by a certain kind of performativity of it. But that's just mm-hmm. basically true of all of this, right? And that's what you're pointing to. What is your theory for what you're seeing when you see Robin DiAngelo doing the work, or what you view as a kind of like uncomfortable fetishization of Ibram Kendi?
Yeah. Yeah, I see everything. The way you put it was probably smarter than what I see, which is that we are enduring, it's a year ago, and we're enduring a plague.
Yes.
And we're all inside.
Yes.
And
that's
spring,
also true.
Spring is turning into summer, and there's this extremely egregious cop murder of a black man. And people are justifiably upset, but also, and I'm not trying to sound snarky about this, but also, we've been inside for months, and the protest against him was a motivation for getting outside and connecting with other people and being near other people. I completely understand that. But what then happened around June of 2020 was proponents of what used to be the obscure school of thought called critical race theory saw what was happening as an opportunity to try to make their way of looking at things have more purchase than it had before. And they found an America uniquely poised to listen to what they were saying. And what they ended up doing was not, say, making their case as, say, a Kimberly Crenshaw would. You know, I'm not saying that there should be no critical race theory. I think critical race theory should be at the table. But you got a certain kind of person who decided that what they were going to do was exert a reign of terror where if people don't agree with you and start refashioning their institutions in the image that you suggest, then you're going to call them terrible names on this thing called Twitter. Very few people are up for that. And so people started buckling under. And so what we're seeing now is not change in people's attitudes as much as a reign of terror. And I don't see that as the fringe. I see that as the core of what's been going on.
I mean, I would respectfully object to the term since no one's at the guillotine yet. But I mean, thank God, right?
No, not physical, no.
No. I mean, I actually find like people often playfully will deploy the guillotine on social media as like, oh, and I'm like, it's like edgy. And I always think that's actually quite gross.
You don't want to minimize. Yeah.
But that actually gets to the other point of it. Like, to the extent that you're saying about the George Floyd protests, which, you know, there was a bunch of things happening at once. And I think it's undeniable that people are being cooped up in their houses. It was the first big thing.
It's inevitable.
Right. Yeah. That's human. I also wonder how much of all of this is just like, in quantifiable statistical terms, the sheer amount of speech in every direction has expanded by a mind-boggling exponential amount.
Definitely.
Like, it's just the case that we used to have most of our speech, 99%. I mean, I would say 10 years ago, 99% of all speech to maybe 99.99999999999% of all speech for all people in American society was effectively private.
Exactly.
And
yes.
Now, like, half of it's public.
Oh,
and
yes.
So it seems to me like the excess is run in both directions, right? Both the kind of like Twitter castigating you're talking about and this kind of like, you know, this, what I will admit, some of these sort of mobbish circling of people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then also people's saying awful things. That all of this is like, it's almost like a statistical inevitability, right? Like, we just like start massively expanding the amount of speech we actually put out into the public.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly we're going to be bumping into these speech problems all the time.
Mm-hmm. And also because of there being so much public speech. It's funny, I was just telling a class today that so much changes in about 2013 or 14 in that sense when social media acquires this real power. One of the things that is going to be public is people being called names. And so it isn't, say, Maude, to use
right.
a TV character, talking in her kitchen to Walter. Instead,
that's right.
It's that you're going to be called these names on social media, and that scares a lot of people to their socks. Most people don't want to be called names in public. And yes, it's inevitable. I mean, once you have Twitter, that sort of thing is inevitable. The kind of name-calling person, the mobbing kind of person is probably very small percentage of what humanity is, but they are going to be there. But their power is therefore inevitably going to be disproportionate. And therefore, you have this, I won't call it a reign of terror, but you have people who are pretending to subscribe to certain ways of doing things because they're very, very afraid, as they tell me directly several times a day. That really does disturb me.
You're ascribing a nefariousness to this that I'm having a hard time.
Not actually, no.
I mean,
I think that these people who are terrorizing people, frankly, they're sincere. They mean it. They truly believe that they are doing good. They feel that they need to treat people this way because in the grand scheme of things, they're creating what they call social justice. They really believe that. I don't think they're evil.
Right. And that opprobrium and shame subjected on people is essentially the price of progress because—
Because
it, what they are doing is they are, by doing that, you know, they're moving the boundary. And that boundary is in the wrong place and they want to move it in the right place.
And there's no other way. Yeah, that's what they believe. I literally do not see these people as— I don't see them as Robespierre's even figuratively. But what they're doing, their idea, you know, they say social justice— and they think they're saying justice. It's kind of like if you say advanced planning, but you could say planning. They think their vision of social justice is justice. I think they're wrong in that, but I can imagine being them and not stopping to consider it. But nevertheless, what they're doing, I still think needs to be checked.
When you talk about critical race theory, I mean, it's a little, that term's a little, it's weird because it's gone through a bunch of different iterations in terms of what it means.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not even sure what we're talking about when we talk about that now. I mean, you mentioned Kimberly Crenshaw, and obviously there's a sort of like, there's a legal academic origin of it, which is sort of talking about the ways in which race factors in the law and the way it's often hidden.
Exactly.
You know, which is the sort of, as far as I understand, the kind of intellectual origins of that phrase in the legal academy. But people use it now a lot in ways that I'm not quite clear what they're referring to.
I think that there's a guiding principle, although it's not usually stated directly. The idea is that battling power differentials is the paramount goal of all intellectual, artistic, or moral endeavor. Battling power differentials. And so if you look at a lot of the media pieces that especially people under about 35 write from that perspective, they may not say critical race theory, but that word power and the way it's being used, that it's all about power, what they mean is that there are all sorts of things one might do or think about, but battling power differentials must be paramount over everything else. And as you see, when you take that proposition and you put it nakedly, it's arbitrary. Power differentials are problematic. It's disgusting when people use their power in untoward ways. And the story of America is getting further and further into understanding that. But for it to be everything, for it to stand athwart all other concerns, that's a really radical proposition that I'm not sure these people can defend.
Well, that, I mean, I think the intellectual line that is being mined there goes back centuries. I mean, you know what I mean? In some ways, like, that's Marx's challenge to liberalism. I mean, Marxian challenge to liberalism is like, you guys think you're having like free of exchange of ideas and all this stuff, and you're just under the thumb of this, of the capitalists.
Right.
So the friction between particularly leftists and liberals on this question, I would, you know, I have sort of straddled those two lines in different parts of my intellectual trajectory. That's an old one, right? Like, and in some ways, it's the one that we're—
And a good one.
Right. And in some ways, it's the one we're fighting out in certain ways here, right? I mean, I do think that, like, there is a kind of ascendant leftism that generationally that is challenging to a kind of liberalism of people. And it's funny you said this 35 thing, because my experience with this is there's a huge generational divide that in some ways is greater than the divide along other lines. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that folks that I know who are 45 plus— tend to be more sympathetic to your camp.
Yep.
Across different lines of difference, like identity,
that's
race,
definitely
like
true.
Including like people who for most of their lives have considered themselves like
liberals,
radical,
or
feminists.
Even leftists.
So exactly, right. Exactly. There are a lot of leftists, self-described and self-understood, black, Latino, gay, like of different—
Who are mystified now.
Yes.
Exactly.
And then there are younger people for whom this is obvious.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Like, that this is the way that speech, you know, that speech is sort of power, and that this sort of all this stuff about debate is like—
What's there to debate? Yeah.
Well, right. Exactly. What's there to debate? But also, but there's a deeper intellectual tradition there, just to give credit to it, right?
Sure.
I mean, the deeper intellectual tradition is that like the terms of debate are set by certain hierarchies, and that like the notion of debating certain things itself is a form of exercise of power or oppression, which is clearly the case in certain circumstances. You just think it's not the case in the ones that you're citing.
Yeah, that's a very subtle point, and it's true. Yeah, to an extent, saying, let's talk about it. There are times when you have to say, no, we've talked about this enough.
Right.
It would be
that's
the equivalent
right.
of saying, let's discuss whether or not women should right. have a vote. No, let's not right. discuss right. it. But right. where do you draw the line on things like this?
And I think who draws it? That's the other thing. I mean, to me, that is really part of it, too. Mm-hmm. And who gets a veto over who draws it? Because mm-hmm. that's part of it also, right? Like, it's if a person says, like, that thing you're saying is offensive to me,
mm-hmm.
we should draw a line there. I don't want to have that debate. What is the proper balance, right, in response to that challenge? And I get this as someone who's on television, right? People send me yeah. emails, say, don't use that term or something like that.
Right.
What's the proper moral, politically righteous, open-minded, broadly, small mm-hmm. L liberal mm-hmm. reaction to that is not a clear path. But I do feel like there's a lot of people who just don't like being told that and have turned their distaste
sure.
in that into an ideology. That,
sure.
that in the same way that you see a kind of like Robespierrian control ethos in the mm-hmm. folks that are on the other side of this, I see a kind of like, fuck you, don't tell me what to do, contrarianism
sure.
in a lot of it too, that's now been pathologized into an ideology, which is like, how dare you tell me I can't use that word?
Right. And of course, all of this makes a certain sense. But then when it gets to the point that, you know, for example, Donald McNeil at the New York Times is reported to have had a conversation where he referred to the N-word in
right.
one conversation, and it was, you know, a rather clinical conversation. This gets reported, and that one thing, you know, there were other little things, but if it hadn't been for this one thing, he would still have his job. Of course, what's behind that is a certain kind of person saying, I don't wish to discuss this. That word shouldn't have come out of his mouth, and therefore he has to go, or the conditions have to be made such that he basically has to resign. And I think the knottiest problem that we have in our society right now is grappling with the fact that sometimes there might be a moral argument that a person who is not white is saying, I don't wish to discuss this, the head must roll. I'm sorry, I keep using these French Revolution analogies, but you know what I mean. And the fact is that a reasonable moral, say, leftist, if we're going to make a facile equation, person
right.
might say in these situations, no, you insisting upon this is unjust in itself. It's uncivil. You're exaggerating.
Right.
How do we decide?
Right.
Can we say that to someone? I think everybody's at the edge of their seats wondering whether they're allowed to even think that. And I think that, frankly, they are. We just have to decide it within what realm.
Right. And then the question of sanction, right? Because, like, there's such a range of sanction. I mean, there's a certain person who says, if someone says to Don McNeil when he gets back from the trip, hey, buddy, the student told us you dropped an N-word.
And could you not do that again?
Let's just not do that.
Which is what originally happened. Yeah.
Right. And, like, it's like, that's a censure. And there's some people who would be like, how dare you tell me that, right? Like, there's some people who would find that censure and sanction excessive and tyrannical and over the top, right? But then there's, like, lose your job. And then there's the thing that I find, you know, the place where I find myself, I think, most sympathetic, and I got people were mad at me on the internet for saying this, which is, you know, a fact of life. But the woman, the former wrestler who played this character on the Star Wars series,
mm-hmm.
Who's got, like, in my mind, truly terrible right-wing politics,
mm-hmm.
and was posting, like, bad and offensive stuff. She made this sort of too cute by half, like, dumb anti-trans joke about her pronouns, which she took down.
Mm-hmm.
And then she posted this really vile mural that's, like, very frankly anti-Semitic in its iconography, although I don't know if people who don't know the history of anti-Semitic iconography understand that what they're posting is anti-Semitic.
Right.
Anyway, so she posts this stuff. She clearly had been warned a few times. She gets kicked off the series.
Mm-hmm.
And my feeling about that is, to me, that's the most extreme version. The place where I'm most worried about this is for people, sanction for speech of people where their job has nothing to do with it,
mm-hmm.
for exactly. their public speech.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is like a really, you know, because the classroom's different, right? Like, not saying that you don't have examples in which the classroom excess is happening,
mm-hmm.
but in a classroom, like, your speech is your job. Right?
Sure.
Like,
sure.
And what you're doing. But, like, an actress on Star Wars, it's like, that's just like, I don't know, she's got terrible views. Like,
right.
And people said, well, they're worse than terrible. They're anti-Semitic. And again, obviously there are some views that you, if you articulate it as the lead actress in a series should get you fired. Mm-hmm. But that to me, like the employment sanction is the most extreme and the one I'm most worried about.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly in contexts where the sanction is for speech unrelated to the job.
Mm-hmm.
That to me seems the most extreme and the most dangerous of these sort of categories.
And what kicked me off was watching this happen to one of my fellow linguists this summer, where a lot of the issue was things that had nothing to do with him being a linguist, and the idea was that he needed to be stripped of his epaulets. I refer to something that happened with Steven Pinker that was in the media for a little while. Yeah, these things are frightening, as is also the issue of time lapse. And so when the person who's been tapped to edit Teen Vogue is not allowed to, because now I've heard that there were some other things going on.
Clearly
in between,
there are, but right.
But really, it was because of things that she wrote 10 years ago when she was essentially a child, where the same people who would argue that we have to have a criminal justice system that's sensitive to atonement won't let somebody atone for something tacky they wrote 10 years ago. It's inconsistent. And so that's where I start thinking this is more about virtue signaling and sometimes just kind of a recreational hostility than really trying to build a better society. You know what I mean?
I would respond to that by saying I think they were worse than tacky. I mean, they were gross and racist. Mm-hmm. But you know, I tweeted after this, like, I'm fine if we just make a rule that, you know, there's like a 18-year-old, it just all disappears from your adult life. I mean, I remember the craziest example of this was there was some draft pick that this happened to. Do you remember this? There's like some kid who got drafted to play some sport and they found some
horrible things. Yeah.
Truly exactly. Vile stuff that he tweeted at 16. It's like, I don't know what to tell you. That's awful. But like,
yeah,
what are we doing here? So, yes, I mean, I agree. And again, I think that's an example of like the quantity of speech overwhelming, sort of overflowing the banks of our ability to deal with it. I also think that the point which is made both in Alexia McCammon's case at Teen Vogue and in Dom McNeil's, which is that things are more complicated than they look when you're dealing with employment situations, is well taken. Although my response on the other side is, to the extent that's the case, it's not really great if this is being used by whoever, whether it's management above her, by staff or whoever, as a kind of proxy for some other battle. Like, that's not actually exculpatory. If you say, well, we are actually having a bunch of battle on some other substantive stuff, and this was sort of like the public-facing proxy, that I don't think that is exculpatory when we're talking about people's employment situations.
No. But would you agree, Chris, that there is more than a little bit of excess here? Or maybe we won't disagree about that. I don't think that it's just that some eggs are being broken. I think that there's a crisis.
Yes, I think that that's where we disagree. I think there's definitely some eggs being broken. I think there's more than a little excess. And I think, you know, the Willie Brown being taken off of San Francisco school seemed nutty to me. I think, you know, again, I think what ends up happening here is that it's all about the question about what are the lines, who draw the lines, the scope of the problem, the severity of it, and the sort of context of what the social problems are in American life. And I think that that's probably where you and I, you know, disagree, right, in terms of how big a problem this is. It's not that I don't think there's nothing there. That's why we're doing the podcast.
Oh, I know. Oh, of course.
Because clearly there is. And again, I think these debates are sort of worth engaging with. I will say this. I mean, I do think that not to be overly formalistic about this, although you're a linguist, so I think you'll be sympathetic. I do think that, like, the venues of Twitter and cable news are basically the worst venues for these kinds of conversations.
Yeah.
And I think that the more that's happening in those places about these kinds of things, the worse the discourse gets.
That is definitely the truth, yes.
You know, like, one of the things that I always said this the other day about Substack, whether, you know, which itself has its own, you know, questions about, you know, moderation.
Right, yeah.
But the one thing I really like about it is, like, back in the day, I'm an old man, but, you know, when I was coming up in the blogosphere, like, someone would write a blog post attacking someone else at 1,500 words, and that person would reply with a 1,500-word response.
Remember that?
In which they would quote in block quotes. And some – look – it got super nasty. It wasn't like people were like, oh, that's so great that you wrote about me. Like, people fought.
But it wasn't so telegraphic. Exactly.
It wasn't so telegraphic, and it wasn't like I screenshotted and now I'm dunking. It was like –
precisely.
People argued. They genuinely argued. And one of the things I've liked about Substack is that there's space for people to argue. If you're going to argue, then argue. But arguing is, that's what humans have been doing. That's probably why they invented language. Well, they actually invented language probably for gossip. But I'm sure they started – they probably started arguing soon after. So I do think that, like, and part of the project here in having this podcast is like finding venues to have these conversations that aren't, you know, at the sort of dial turned up to 11 on the moral fervor and also truncated in the format.
Precisely.
such that you can't actually explore it.
Twitter has been scaring me ever since it began because of that. And I wasn't super active on it until recently because I always said, I can't express myself so briefly, and I don't see how anybody could have a productive discussion. But it's at the point where you have to somehow figure out how to halfway do it, or you don't exist, because that's just where right. All of the heat is. But yeah, Twitter is really, really dangerous, and I miss those blog days as well. And you're right, I've been doing Substack, and it allows you to stretch out in a way that makes you feel like you're participating in the sort of thing that created the Federalist Papers, as opposed to, you know, something written on the
graffiti.
Side of a blimp.
Yeah, exactly. John McWhorter is Associate Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University. His latest book is 9 Nasty Words, English in the Gutter, Then Now and Forever. He has a Substack as well. And when you and Glenn Lowry have those conversations, where are those posted?
They're just posted at the Blogging Heads site.
Oh, right. They're at Blogging Heads, right.
Yeah, we have a Patreon now, but then a week later, they're available to everybody at Blogging Heads. Yeah.
Bloggingheads.tv. John, thanks so much. I really enjoyed that.
Chris, this was exquisite. Thank you very much.
Once again, my great thanks to John McWhorter. His latest book, 9 Nasty Words, English in the Gutter, Then, Now, and Forever, is out this May, so you should definitely check that out. Like he said, you could also find him at bloggingheads.tv, or you can search for his Substack. I'd love to hear your thoughts. There's a lot to give feedback on this particular topic. I know that people probably have a lot to say, so definitely, Tiffany wants to read all of your emails. You should send them withpod@gmail.com or tweet us with the hashtag withpod. Why Is This Happening is presented by MSNBC and NBC News, produced by the All In team, and features music by Eddie Cooper. You can see more of our work, including links to things we mentioned here, by going to nbcnews.com/whyisthishappening.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.